Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Acting CEO at League of Education Voters, also known as LEV. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. Restraint and isolation are supposed to be rare practices, but they are not. Isolation rooms, found within many of Washington's public schools and educational institutions, and restraining students must only be used when a student's behavior poses an imminent likelihood of serious harm. However, isolation and restraint of students are commonly used as classroom management tools to induce compliance or otherwise punish or discipline students for non-compliant behavior in violation of state law. Isolation and restraint in schools hurts our most vulnerable students. The overwhelming majority of students subject to restraint and isolation practices are elementary school students. There are egregious disparities in the practices of restraint and isolation against Black students, multiracial students, low-income students, unhoused students, students in foster care, and students with disabilities. Restraint and isolation are punitive and penal experiences for students and can have lasting harmful effects. In this episode, we will talk with a school principal about alternatives to using isolation and restraint practices on students, a school board member about district policies that prevent the use of isolation and limit restraint, and former students who were subjected to these practices. Justin Hendrickson is the principal of South Shore Creek K-8 in Seattle Public Schools, and I'm proud to say that South Shore didn't have any incidents of isolation and restraint in the 2021-2022 school year. Justin, why was that?
I think it really just goes back to relationships, and it goes back to building trustful spaces with students and families and working with our staff to let them know that unless a student is a direct threat to themselves or to other students or staff, that we stay hands off. And that has been a shift over the years in moving away from making decisions too quickly, specifically around students that are triggered or have something going on where they're not necessarily in control and ready to problem solve at a specific moment. In my experience, most of the times by putting hands on a student, that tends to escalate things as opposed to de-escalate. So we really want to try to be proactive, think de-escalation the whole way, think about it, is there a preferred adult that the student responds to better, get them on a walkie-talkie, see if they can meet them and talk them down. To me, that also goes back to the relationships, the trust, and knowing our kids.
Yeah. How do you build that trust with kids? I mean, what is your process for doing that?
I think it's day by day. It's a relationship. And we've all had relationships, and we know that we can take a couple steps forward, and sometimes we take a couple steps back, but we keep showing up. And I think that's a big part of finding success with students, specifically students who have experienced isolation restraint, perhaps in other schools or other settings. There's some unlearning that needs to happen first in how we train our staff not to react, because sometimes students are looking for reactions. Just like if you are lucky enough to have a child of your own kids do that sometimes. They look for you to see how you're going to react. Sometimes it's attention, but they're communicating with you. It's not always acceptable communications, but there are opportunities to teach into those more acceptable forms of communications and other activities that could get the student what they want and not necessarily be destructive or harmful.
So what kind of training do staff receive? I mean, is this every single person in your building that receives this training? And what does that look like?
Right. It depends. As a school that has social emotional learners, we have specific staff who are assigned to this group of students, and they do receive additional training around de-escalation holds that you would use if you were ever had to do a hold, the process to de-escalate. Specifically, we talk a lot about when students run or elope, as we call it, how do we keep them safe and also keep them in lines of sight? And how do we make sure that they know sort of the boundaries around those? Because a lot of times, specifically students that are new to us at times, like getting chased is a fun thing, particularly for younger students sometimes. So once it's not as much fun, typically we can slow those down. As our whole staff, we also do de-escalation trainings that we tend to practice and use different scenarios on as well. We don't have to pull something from a book. We typically have some sort of real life scenario that has happened and how would we respond. For teachers that are serving students who do have some additional layers of trauma or have an IEP that may be a little more intense than another student's IEP. We work with those staff around sort of emergency procedures or protocols, whether that be, you know, having all of the other students be removed from the classroom. There are different ways that you can do things. Specifically, we think proactively if we are able to communicate and work with students on communicating, specifically when they have something that becomes overwhelming. That could look like, you know, just really building that level of trust to know that if a student is going to blow out of a classroom, they blow out and they leave and they go to another spot that they feel more comfortable with. That's a more acceptable sort of behavior than sort of ripping up a classroom. And, you know, sometimes it goes really quickly and we get on the same page quick. And sometimes it takes a little bit longer. And then also we lean on district supports as well that can help us specifically if there's a student who's perplexing us a little more. There are some amazing folks downtown who are able to help us problem solve and maybe think of some things outside of the box that might work as well.
That's great. And often when there are these big behaviors, there's a cause for it. I mean, you already
absolutely
alluded to the fact that behavior is communication.
It is. There's a trigger somewhere.
Yep. How do you find the trigger? I mean, does your building have protocols around that, trying to
figure
out what's going on?
There's lots of different ways to sort of go about it. And then one of the beautiful things about children is each one of these kiddos is different and special in their own way. So it's never a cookie cutter. You know, you can look at a functional behavior analysis, behavior intervention plan. There's lots of different ways to sort of use data to kind of figure this out. Like if Justin's really struggling and acting out every time we switch to fractions, maybe there's something going on with math right now that's really hard for him. So let's see about that. Maybe we can differentiate in there, or maybe we can try to approach it a little bit differently. You're trying to find out sort of what the antecedent is, like what happened before, and then unlearning that. And then with the right team in place, sometimes you can teach replacement behaviors, or you can teach some communication skills that maybe the student didn't have to communicate how they're feeling before it becomes a place of fight or flight. It takes a team. It takes gathering data. It takes building trust in the relationship with the student. But sometimes they'll just tell you if you got a good enough relationship, you know, like, hey, when this kid does this to me, it really gets me going. Okay, so let's separate you guys. Let's figure out a way to not have you guys interact here, or let's try a different way to do this. And we've seen some great success with students over the years on finding some replacement behaviors, or even giving them the language and the communication skills to advocate for themselves when they feel that something's coming on that they're maybe not going to be in control of themselves.
One thing about South Shore is that you have students who are in preschool and you have students who are in eighth grade. So yep. You're basically looking at little kids all the way up to students who are the same size as adults.
Yep.
How hard has it been to establish these protocols and trainings and de-escalation techniques with such a wide range of students?
It's definitely not a light switch. And I think that there's some opportunities to learn from other places that have been already doing this. There's a lot of research about this. And one of the great things about South Shore is that typically we do hold on to our kids for a long time. And so getting to know our students and have the opportunity to have staff in the school who have worked with the student for sometimes years has allowed the new folks who come to work with us to understand that we do things a little differently, that we are a hands-off school. That doesn't mean that there's not accountability. It doesn't mean that we're not trying to keep students safe and that we don't think about the impact that sometimes big behaviors can have on classrooms, staff, students. But there is a different way to do this. We're not perfect at it, but we do really abide by keeping our hands off kids. You know, besides fist bumps and high fives, kids need to be able to maneuver and learn and communicate without worry of adults restraining or isolating them, specifically when it's something that is not a safety concern.
Justin Hendrickson is the principal of South Shore Pre-K through 8 in Seattle Public Schools. Justin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Eric. Always good to see you.
Liza Rankin is the current vice president of the Seattle Public Schools Board of Directors. Liza, as a district, how has Seattle moved away from using isolation and restraint practices?
We started from the board level in looking at current district policy and practices in January 2020. Now, President Hersey and I at the time were on the Student Services Curriculum and Instruction Committee and part of the process of those committees, and I was the chair. was bringing forward a list of priorities to come through the committee for that year. Brandon Hersey and I both immediately put addressing issues of isolation and restraint as our pretty much our number one priority and started talking to staff about where we need to start to address that, especially as it relates to, we were really interested in disproportionality in racial representation among students who experience those practices and also the overwhelming presence of students with disabilities in those practices. And then COVID hit and we had to sort of put a pause on policy work that wasn't either directly related to COVID or deemed necessary for the operation of the district. In spite of that, for the next several months, I kept working with staff and talking to parents, educators, folks over at Children's Hospital at the PDMU, just their behavioral unit at OSPI, anybody I could talk to about best practices in isolation and restraint. The goal really was to eliminate isolation.
Now, was there an incident that triggered this, the interest in trying to ban isolation and limit restraint?
There wasn't specifically at that point. It was an issue that was important to me when I ran for this position. I think President Hersey, as an educator and in his position coming to the board, was just something that we both were aware of was an issue that we wanted to address. And then, of course, not too long after, the story of the child at an elementary school in Seattle was publicized and reignited the conversation around it. That was in, I think, fall or winter of 2020. We had already been kind of establishing groundwork of what would it look like? What changes would we need to make in policy to affect the changes that we want to see for our students? Once we were allowed to, by the governor, work on approving policies that weren't directly related to COVID, this one was at the top of our list. We knew we wanted to eliminate isolation completely and reduce restraint to the extent possible. And we also knew that it wouldn't happen overnight, that we needed more information about what was happening in schools, tightening some things up around reporting, and to really understand exactly what we were dealing with. And some of that's still in process as it relates to the passage of the policy. You know, when the policy gets passed, it doesn't suddenly change everything.
Yeah.
But it kind of sets the new target of this is what we want. This is the goal. In doing that, that directs the superintendent and the district to shift practices to meet the standards laid out in the policy.
You spoke with educators, you talked with parents, and you talked with staff to sort of craft this policy that you have now. And what is the policy? How would you describe it?
The policy specifically states that isolation is a banned practice, clearly defines in alignment with the state definition what a restraint is and when it can be used. Because not all restraints are prohibited. There are times when, for the safety of a student or a classroom, a restraint might be absolutely the necessary intervention in that moment in time. What we were really concerned about was trying to help the whole system delineate between emergency intervention and use of these practices as a disciplinary measure. And I know the report that came out from Disability Rights Washington and ACLU, we know that that's not unique to Seattle by any means, that that's an issue around the state of Washington.
Yeah.
We wanted to get that into policy, really clearly defining when a restraint is permissible or even necessary, and when it's not. And when it's not, what should be done instead?
Mm-hmm. Well, what should be done instead?
Well, so the policy states a little higher level, and that's very purposeful because we want the superintendent and staff and the practitioners to be determining the how to do these things. The policy is really, this is what we expect, what we want.
Okay.
In the broader sense, what I learned from talking with all kinds of folks was there's nobody going into a classroom saying, I really want this to be what I do as children. You know, no, I don't think there's anybody who would say this is ideal. You know, what we found and what a lot of people know is restraint and isolation are typically used when the resources aren't there for an alternative. in the broader scope, creating classrooms where students are fully included as their whole selves, where students feel safe and supported, where students can express themselves in safe ways, creating those more inclusive classrooms that are more accepting of behavior that might not meet the current typical standard is one part. That's bigger and squishier than some of these other things.
Yes.
But that's really kind of the foundation of shifting towards truly inclusionary practices, which means having classrooms where students can participate as their whole selves and where the support that they need is present.
Yeah.
In the moment, though, a lot of what replacing restraint looks like is prevention, mm-hmm. which is part of that classroom environment, but also in, you know, addressing behaviors or issues with kids before they reach the moment of crisis intervention.
Yeah.
Not always possible. Restraint and isolation are not used randomly or evenly across student populations. It tends to be the same children that are being restrained multiple times.
Yeah.
I was going to say throughout the year, but sometimes even during one day, multiple times. That requires a shift towards a more proactive approach instead of a reactive approach. That means planning time for teachers to talk about what's working and what's not working with one particular child and including the family. Mm-hmm. That could mean, okay, here's some strategies we've done that haven't worked. Let's talk about what other strategies we may have, or we've now come to the point where we need to bring in someone from central offices, or we need to bring in a school psychologist or something to consult to figure out what's happening because there's a pattern here that we don't want to have continue. And I think currently, a lot of times people don't have the time to do that, or they don't feel they can do that for whatever reason, whether it just because there are not enough of those additional resources to call upon, or because those folks are trying to get to multiple other schools and they're sort of on the list. Or sometimes it's just simply that there's too many kids, too many needs, and they're not totally sure what to ask for. It's a very reactive scenario that we have happening in a lot of buildings where just there's no time to deal with it other than in the moment. And so shifting practice to trying to move up that critical time of intervention to before there's an emergency is part of what we know will be effective.
Yeah. How has implementation of this been going for the 106 Seattle schools?
When we first passed the policy, staff had a 3-year planned rollout of training happening in every building. There's been a lot of other initiatives that have come in at the same time that will support this work, but may not directly be related. So Universal Design for Learning, is something that Seattle Public Schools is focused on. And I believe we have something like 30 schools that principals have been trained. They will roll out that training into buildings also. Yes, it's about the resources and it's about training, but it's also about kind of a collective mindset shift. And that again is squishier and harder to point to, but all these different pieces should progress to the point where they're all supporting reducing isolation and restraint because we're shifting how we as a system respond to children in behavioral crises. So it's been very positively received. I don't think it's gotten to everybody. There's still a lot of iterative work going on. But, you know, for the most part, as far as I have experienced, people want this support and training. They know it's better for kids. They want better for their students and for themselves. Anything we can do to improve the educational environment for students is improving the working environment for staff as well. And, you know, staff want to be in a place where they're giving children the support that they need. So this has been positive.
That's great. Do you see full implementation of this within the next year or 2 years? Will it be pretty soon?
I'm not 100% sure, actually, but part of the policy change was a requirement of annual reporting to the board from the superintendent. And this spring will be the first full year cycle where we will have that baseline report since the changes of this policy. So I am really eagerly anticipating getting that report and having that conversation and having some more concrete information about what is and isn't happening in our buildings.
Yeah, and then you can adjust from there.
Yep.
So is there anything you'd like to say to policymakers or educators or parents about alternatives to isolation and restraint?
The kind of biggest takeaway that I might have from all of this is that there is no demonstrated therapeutic or educational benefit to isolation. I think that's just something that has to be said straight up. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't situations where sometimes people feel like that's the only option they have at that point. But I think we have to all acknowledge that when isolation happens, it is not benefiting that child. Collectively, we can eliminate it. We absolutely can. I have complete faith in every educator, student, principal that we can teach children with isolation completely off the table. Again, doesn't mean that there won't be times where a child needs to be removed from a classroom or have an alternative location where they may be engaging in education or other activities, but we can 100% do without isolation as defined by the state.
Liza Rankin is the current vice president of the Seattle Public Schools Board of Directors. Liza, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for talking about this important issue with me today.
Dorian Taylor is a former student who went to school just outside of Houston. Dorian, how would you introduce yourself?
I'm a Black, I guess at this point in my life, middle-aged. I'm an advocate. I work in disability policy at the county government level, but I am also a grassroots organizer. So it's pretty much how I would describe myself. Lover of the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you're here in Washington State.
Right. Exactly.
So what did you experience when you were a student in Houston?
I grew up in the 80s and 90s. My public school experience was extremely harsh. I'm autistic, but that wasn't something that was diagnosed very much, you know, especially with the female assigned kids. I'm transgender. So I was, you know, treated as, you know, a little girl when I was a kid. And the way, like, Black kids are treated is just drastically different. And I had this, like, fever as a baby. And so all my behaviors was blamed on this, like, high fever that I had when I was a little baby. They were just like, we don't know what's going on with them. It's probably due to their fevers. A lot of my experiences in, like, elementary school, I remember when my behaviors would get sort of out of control, they would put me in closets. I was often put in utility closets. When I was in elementary school, I wasn't in special ed, but I'm not aware at the time these problems started happening if those kinds of special ed classrooms were even a thing, because we're talking like 1989 at this point, you know, when my experiences of being placed in utility closets. I spent a lot of my youth in state hospitals and stuff as well. So that started at that time. And of course, like, seclusion rooms is a part of that whole experience. But I will say a lot of what I remember about my experience as a youth in elementary school, I remember being provoked a lot by the teachers. I remember teachers pushing me, almost teasing me, when I would get upset or elevated and my voice would rise and I wouldn't be able to respond. And I remember often asking for moments to calm down and then return to the scenario. And I remember never being allowed to calm down. The teachers always, sometimes even chasing me to finish these conversations. And I remember that happening all through high school. Junior high and high school, I feel, was like when that started to escalate for me, when I was finally placed in special education classrooms and when I experienced restraints the most. And they almost always would start from a scenario. So when I get stimulated, still to this day, you know, if I get put on the spot, I might get a little elevated. I might not be able to get out or articulate what it is that I want to say.
Yeah.
When there's like heavy emotions involved. Sometimes when I get excited, especially like angry or elevated, I can't control the volume of my voice. I would sometimes quite literally be begging for just like 15 minutes to allow myself to de-escalate. And these adults just being like, you can't do that in the real world. That's not something you'll ever be able to do. Quite literally provoking me to this point where I would explode. And then I would be getting restraints. I'd be getting thrown in seclusion rooms and sometimes state institutions after that, right? And sometimes it would escalate beyond the classroom. I do credit those experiences a lot to my experiences with being a survivor of the school to prison pipeline, because a lot of these incidents, they would be escalated into criminal offenses, and I would end up in hospitals or what have you. And then so by the time I was 17, I was just tried as an adult for misdemeanor offenses outside of school. I already had juvenile records already based on these incidences that happened to me at school.
Yeah, I mean, you were just asking for a moment, 15 minutes just to calm down. That doesn't seem unreasonable.
No, and one thing that I always like to point out that, you know, I'm in my 40s now, so I've had some time to be an adult. In my experiences as an adult, I actually find that's never been true. And that's what I find the most heartbreaking about the experiences that I've had. And I really describe it as adults picking on me. Like I would actually have teachers, they would try to mainstream me, that would read about my behaviors and my IEPs and then purposely try to provoke me as if that was supposed to toughen me up. And what it did was take away the safe spaces that I had in school and the places that I did enjoy learning. It just took those places away from me. And all it did was make school a very painful experience, you know, and a very traumatic experience for me.
Yeah, what do you think the schools should have done differently? I mean, other than giving you space and not using your IEP as trigger points, basically.
Right. I do like to say that I often think that on top of like not handling disability in the ways that they should have, I do feel there was some racial discrimination that was added to that, oftentimes being one of the only. I went to predominantly white schools in the 80s and 90s in the South. So I'm just going to be very clear about that being part of it. And also teachers just not being used to, like, culturally, we express emotions in more vibrant ways. And I think there's a cultural fear of Black emotions, right? And I say that because cultural awareness is important. But I also think that listening was a huge, huge part of what was never done. It's really easy for adults to think that we have all the answers and that it's easy to disrespect children as not understanding their situation. And they might not understanding if their situation is completely, but my experience is I often knew what I needed to handle the situation appropriately. Just allowing me a safe space to calm down that wasn't a closet. Like, there's a difference between being put in a closet and then, you know, allowing me to be empowered in the decision as a child, because it was a missed opportunity to teach me how to handle my emotions, right? Because on the flip side, what happened is I became an adult who didn't have emotional skills to handle when I became elevated, right? There was lots of missed opportunities. Like, that's what behavioral classrooms are supposed to teach you, is how to deal with those kinds of behaviors. But instead, I was just thrown in closets or restrained. You add that to there not really being support for autistic adults. This became help that I had to seek on my own with no resources, you know, and being taught the skills to handle such strong emotions, because it also took me a long time to realize that I wasn't as powerful as they were making me out to be. I grew up thinking that I was someone to be feared, that my emotions were scary, and that scary emotions only got handled in these certain ways, right? And which in turn taught me how to stuff my own emotions, maybe not reach out for help when I needed to because I would be afraid that I didn't say things in certain ways, you know, if I got too scared. There's some really missed opportunities to like teach a really young, scared child how to handle big emotions, right? You know, because if those emotions are can be scary for an adult, imagine what it feels like to be this little kid who has those big emotions that you see the adults are scared of, but you don't know how to handle them either, right? You know, and it's the adults that were supposed to be teaching me those skills.
Absolutely. That's a big thing, the whole social emotional skills and recognizing what you're experiencing and then trying to think, okay, where do I want to be? And then what are some tools to get me to where I want to get to?
Right.
So a number of policymakers are going to be listening to this podcast. If you could speak to state legislators or school board members or school superintendents, what would you say to them?
I would say that, honestly, restraints, I think it's a farce. And I say that because it's really a power dynamic, right, being played out between a disabled child and an adult under the guise of behavior modification, right? Under the guise of like a training skill. But that's not true. You know, it could be further from the truth. Washington prides itself in being a progressive state, right? A state that cares more than other states. And this thing, we're really behind, like decades behind. Like the state that I grew up with, I graduated in 98. They got rid of this in 2001, you know? So we're looking at a generational difference in reality of how behind we are. As legislators, like, they have the power to educate themselves in this subject and the damage, the lifelong damage that this causes from survivors from this. And I do say a survivor of this trauma in school for a reason. And I think that legislatures can have the power to change that, right? They have the power to change that and the power to be ahead of something.
Dorian Taylor works in disability justice at the county level here in Washington State. Dorian, thank you so much for joining me.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Thanks for allowing me to be a part of this.
Chris Baglian is a former student who had to endure isolation and restraint practices when he was a kid. If you were to introduce yourself, what would you say?
I'd say that I'm a man trying to better himself after being forgotten and abused by the systems that are in play today. I grew up in an abusive, alcoholic household. You know, my mom was a single mother. There's a lot of partying, fighting, going crazy, sleep deprivation. A lot of nights I wasn't getting to sleep till 2-3 o'clock in the morning.
And you were how old?
Between the ages of 9 and 13, 14. Thing is that, you know, I don't blame my mom for her alcoholism because there was nobody there to help her.
Yeah.
She was a struggling mother that, you know, went to college to start a career for herself. And instead, the school system put nothing but grief on her. And one thing after the other, with when it came to my behavioral issues, the system caused her to fall, was nowhere around when she needed help. That's something that I'm still trying to, you know, accept, is that part of this isn't just her fault. Yes, she drank and she had issues, but the stress, the loss of work, constant meetings and appointments with people that didn't really understand what the true problems were. So I'm trying to get past what happened to me, and I'm 30 years old and I'm just now awakening to my past and the corruption and wrongdoing that I endured due to the school system and how much pressure they put on parents.
Yeah. So instead of trying to figure out what was behind the behavior that was showing up in the classroom, the put you in an isolation room and kept you from getting educated? Is that what was going on?
Well, it started out when I was in grade school, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. They didn't really know how to manage my attention needs. They took that as me needing to be disciplined and me being poorly behaved. And I ended up sitting in an office at a desk by myself for hours some days, or if not that, then I was sweeping their basketball court or doing janitorial work. They didn't know how to engage with me in a way that would get me to engage back with them. That went up until I reached middle school, and the middle school didn't know how to engage with me either.
What do you wish they would have done instead? What would proper engagement, you know, a way of meeting your needs kind of where you're at, what would that have looked like if you could go back in time and tell them, hey, if only you could do this instead?
I think that the school systems, I understand that everybody needs an education and that everybody needs a system in place to help parents. You know, we all got to work, we all got to do this, but not every kid can be educated the same way.
No.
Some of us, you know, me personally, I was a hands-on kid, hands-on learner. I engaged with my hands, not through reading and writing and stuff like that. I wanted to build. I wanted to tinker. I wanted to be doing something constantly. There's so many different things, the STEM projects and all that, that could have constantly driven my engagement up. Mm-hmm. Back then, they were still developing items like that, but there's so many different ways that they could have engaged with me rather than just leaving me alone and isolating me. They would call it, you know, ISS, in-school suspension. Mm-hmm. They would basically just have me sit there at a desk and do my homework or just sit there. 9 out of 10 times, I just sit there. I'm teaching myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no teacher there. I was literally in a hallway by myself for hours. And then they'd ask you, oh, Mr. Baglian, you feel like you can go back? And I'd slump it off like, eh, I don't care. Like, you guys don't care. I don't care. It's almost like if you're not here to learn, you shouldn't be here at all. And if you're not going to learn, we're going to penalize your parents. I mean, they could have done so many different things, but instead they didn't care. They didn't have the patience for me. They didn't want to work with me.
Right. It's more like if you're not here to learn in the one way that we have for everybody, doesn't seem fair.
Then you're just an outcast and we're going to separate you from the rest of the kids that will learn.
Mm-hmm.
And it just got worse and worse and worse. They had two rooms that were like 4 feet wide by 5 feet deep that were pretty much concrete rooms with a solid steel door, a small little window for them to look in on you. Me, I was a mouthy kid. I was never physical. That's mm-hmm. the one thing that I will say is that I didn't get physical or violent towards anybody. I was dismissive. I was defensive, but never violent. I only had one altercation with another student at that school the entire time I was there, and it was in defense. But yet I got punished for it as if I committed the offense.
And was this a school for high school age students?
Yes. Well, this school was a mix. It went from pre-K all the way up to high school.
And how old were you when you went there?
So it was my 7th and 8th grade, so 13 and 14.
Okay.
If I mouthed off or was discontent with what their program was, they would either push me out of the room into an isolation, one of their non-open door isolation room. If I was mouthy and said, no, I'm not going to leave, you know, you're not going to make me leave. I'm here. I'm learning. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. You're not going to make me leave. They would grab me up and make me leave. If I struggled, another one had come in until the point where it got up to where I would have 4 or 5 full, you know, adult males grabbing me up by each limb, taking me into this room pressing me up against the corner until I quit struggling.
Wow.
It got to the point where I could go for an hour. I could go for 2 hours. The stamina and the fight in me just got stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger every time they did it. Basically, it was on my terms. I never let them have the upper hand in that. I let my mood, you know, whether I wanted to fight them or not, control that situation. Once they shut the door, that was it. If it happened early in the morning, there's the potential that I could have been in there all the way up until 2:30 till the bus came. I'd be stuck in a room with a solid steel door, 4x5 concrete room, solid steel door with literally a medieval, like, sliding brace lock.
Like a bolt, something to block the door from opening.
Yeah, solid steel swing arm into a hook. I'd just go to sleep. I'd spent hours and hours and hours sleeping on that concrete cold. And, you know, that they're not warm rooms.
No.
I literally had to start dressing for that. Carhartt pants, long johns, big Carhartt jacket, just so I could be warm when I went to sleep in that room.
Just in preparation for what was going to happen, you knew you had to bring warm clothes to school.
Yeah.
That's messed up.
Yeah, out of the two and a half years I was there, I spent at least a quarter of that time in those rooms, not counting the other open room, which I slept in there too. Literally, I would come to school and I would sleep half the time. They didn't engage with me at all.
They didn't even try.
No. All they wanted to do was talk to me, talk to me, talk to me, talk to me. Have to talk to the counselor, talk to the counselor. The thing is that, you know, kids are stupid in a sense, and they defend the ones they love. No kid wants to be taken from their parents.
Right.
No kid wants to be taken from their home, uprooted. Had they looked past my lies, you know, and my protecting my family, I probably would have been removed from my house and put into a better situation. But that doesn't mean that they're not in the wrong, and that the system wasn't in the wrong in the first place, because if they would have actually been there to help my mom and support her and help bring structure to our family, none of us would have ever been there.
It sounds like what you went through didn't prepare you well for high school.
No, I dropped out my sophomore year. I tried and I tried and tried. Schools, you know, everything you're doing wrong is a problem, but everything you're doing right is ignored. I didn't get to do anything that I wanted to do when I went to high school. I wasn't allowed to participate in, like, the automotive program or anything like that that I really wanted to. But because I had the issues that I had prior, they wouldn't let me do it. So they wouldn't let me do something that would have made me engage and be happy in this fear that I'd be a threat to somebody. But that's the thing, is they don't know how to tell the difference between a kid with developmental issues and a kid struggling with abuse and neglect at home.
We could use more training for both administrators and teachers to be able to tell the difference.
Absolutely. It's like me being a parent, I have two boys, and I'm kind of going through this same thing with my son. You know, he's having emotional problems. I don't drink alcohol. I'm not the best father. I won't lie. I'm an asshole sometimes, and I don't know how to fix it. I went through testicular cancer, and I disappeared from the face of the earth for a year and a half, and I regret every single second of it. I was an emotional wreck, and I distanced myself from my family and my friends, not knowing whether I was going to succumb from this or not. For some reason in my brain, with the fight or flight, I decided to flight when it came to my family, hoping that it'll be easier for them to move on. So I'm working on myself. I'm seeking counseling for all of that stuff. And I'm at the same time going to school, trying to better myself in every capacity, in every way possible.
Chris Baglian is a father and a college student in Skagit County in the automotive program. Chris, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more about League of Education Voters or support our work, please visit our website, educationvoters.org.